WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dreger. Yesterday, the FDA approved new COVID injections. We're going to look at what pathologist Dr. Ryan Cole had to say over the weekend about them. Plus, Congress is back in session and sparks are already beginning to fly as Republicans signal they're likely to try and impeach Biden and open to shutting down the government if that's what it takes to curb spending. We'll look at these stories and more. But first, South Dakota has once again said no to carbon capture pipelines and landowners are taking a victory lap. On Monday, South Dakota's Public Utilities Commission unanimously denied Summit Carbon Solutions permit to run a carbon capture pipeline across South Dakota. The motion came from the Utility Commission's lead staff attorney, Kristen Edwards, who said that Summit couldn't meet pipeline ordinances passed in four counties. Summit admitted it couldn't follow local standards, but it also had sued several counties, accusing them of overstepping their authority. Summit's lawsuits claim that federal law supersedes state and local government standards on federally regulated pipelines, an assertion that flies in the face of the United States Constitution. The Public Utilities Commission disagreed with the company. South Dakota law requires that transmission projects adhere to all state and local requirements. Independent journalist Matthew Monfort spoke with two South Dakota landowners, Mark Lapka and Jared Bosley, after the ruling.
The PUC in the state of South Dakota denied the application for the Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline, and for all intents and purposes, there's no active application. It's shut down. Could it come back later? Possibly, but we're all feeling very good at the moment. We're going to live in the moment, and we're really going to enjoy the rest of the day.
Absolutely. That's it. You're either a patriot or you're a communist. There's no in between anymore. Us Americans that are patriots, we got to stand together. It's just time to take this nation back one little win at a time.
The landowners' victory comes at the heels of another win last week when South Dakota's Public Utilities Commission also unanimously denied the application for another carbon capture pipeline. Like its Summit competitor, Navigator CO2 Ventures could not meet county standards, nor could it prove that its pipeline would not pose a serious threat to people and the environment. These wins are great, but the fight is far from over. Carbon capture is backed by billions in federal subsidies in support of Joe Biden's net zero fantasies, and both companies can appeal the rulings. Last year, Navigator moved its headquarters from Dallas, Texas to Omaha, Nebraska, a sign of its dedication to the $2.5 billion Heartland Greenway system that it has planned, which is more than 1,300 miles throughout South Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. Likewise, Summit is investing $4.5 billion in its 2,100-mile Midwest Carbon Express through Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, and North and South Dakota. Both companies are private and for profit, and both have threatened to use eminent domain to confiscate private property and farmland throughout the nation's Corn Belt. Brian Jord of Domina Law Group is representing many farmers and landowners in defense of their private property, which stands in carbon capture's crosshairs. After Utility Commission's ruling, he explained what Summit is going to do next.
Well, we expect them to kind of go back hat in hand to the counties, the ones they threatened with lawsuits have strong-armed and have been, frankly, not appropriate in their dealings, to try to basically beg them to do something. But at the end of the day, the route they've proposed is not intelligent. It doesn't fit within South Dakota values and county ordinances. And if they want to come back, fine, that's their right, but come back with a better plan and a better route and listen to the people this time.
After the news segment, we're going to play an interview I conducted at the JBS Leadership Conference this weekend with popular agricultural radio personality Trent Luce, who will be discussing the benefits of CO2 and other ag-related issues. But first, I'm going to go over to my very capable colleague, Steve Bonta, who's the executive senior editor of The New American Magazine. Hi, Steve.
Hi. How are you, Paul? I just had to stifle two sneezes off air, so if I look a little bit red-eyed, that's why.
All right, well, we'll keep that in mind, and if we have to, we'll edit that sneeze out. So you and I spent the weekend in Des Moines, Iowa, and we saw, met people, we saw people, and we talked to legislators and whatnot. And if it weren't for the action of birchers and legislators and all these people who care, we obviously wouldn't have seen this this victory here. So it just goes to show that obviously action isn't futile. It works. And this is inspiring, if anything.
It is. And, you know, big picture, I hope that this proves to be the beginning, not just of the end of all this carbon capture nonsense, but of a broader and long overdue movement to get the federal government out of the agriculture sector. And this is, unfortunately, this has been around for 100 years now. Mm. That there's been a, you know, and it started with, you know, crop subsidies and accompanying mandates about, you know, production mandates and all this type of thing way back in the 1920s and 1930s, and accelerated, of course, during the New Deal. And from and we've sort of, well, certainly in the Midwest, I used to live in the state of Nebraska. I worked at a small town bank there for a couple of years, worked with a lot of farmers, saw up close how intertwined now the entire farming sector is with the federal government. So, for example, you know, people are getting very upset about the carbon capture pipelines and everything that's going on. There was much less chagrin back in the 1970s through the 1990s when all the ethanol mandates and subsidies came in, because that, you know, obviously was seen as a windfall for Midwestern farmers. And in the short term, it was, you know, and today, by law, farmers, all fuel needs to contain a certain amount of biofuel, which means typically ethanol, which of course is derived from corn. And the result is that vast swaths of the farm belt now effectively are given over to the product, not to producing food for people, but for producing, you know, food for cattle. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different story we'll get into. But obviously for producing corn that can be rendered to create ethanol mandated by the federal government, subsidized by the same, and all this type of thing. So that's been, those are a few of many examples of the apparently beneficent hand of the federal government giving to the farm sector, and now they're taking away. This is the problem. So it's a matter of principle, and I hope that people's eyes will be open to this, that same hand that ostensibly is the benefactor of the farmers coming in there and, you know, bailing them out in bad years and of course mandating crops and giving them the nice commodity credit corporation checks, subsidy checks, yeah, once or twice a year, that same hand can just as easily take away and can say, okay, now it's time that you bend to this mandate or that because of some new, you know, environmental conceit. Right now it happens to be this obsession over controlling carbon emissions. Who knows what it'll be 10 years down the line or 20 years down the line, but it's the principle that's important.
Yeah, I mean, I covered agriculture for a while out there in Montana, and I too was surprised at how dependent these farmers, who are otherwise very independent, I mean, especially up in the North Country, I mean, you have some of these people, they're just, some of them have farms the size of miles and they're so separated and they have that homesteader mentality. But then to see them having taken subsidies for such a long time, like you said, hopefully we learn something.
Well, and this is to clarify, this is not to blame the farmers, because the economics, yeah, of the agriculture sector are now so distorted that it's well nigh impossible for someone not to participate in the program, mm-hmm, and still make enough money to get by. I knew, you know, in the course of my couple of years of working in a bank in Seward, Nebraska, there were, you know, a handful of farmers that would come in and say, well, I'm not involved with that, but it's correspondingly much harder for me to make a profit each year, because of course today the idea is to keep the food prices, you know, the grain prices artificially low, mm-hmm, so that the consumers are benefiting. You know, and then that means that you're dependent on that $30,000 or $50,000 check coming in from the CCC every year. If you don't get that, you know, the prices are still the same. They're kept artificially, yeah, low, but you suffer. Back in the 1930s, it was the opposite. The politics of the day dictated that you support the farmer. And so to keep prices artificially high, we had grotesqueries like the Roosevelt administration literally sending massive barges covered with grain out into the ocean and just disposing of it.
Yeah.
You know, millions of tons of grain went to waste all for this cause of keeping the prices high to support the farmer. So it's just this endless.
They did that with livestock too. They drowned livestock. Or pigs,
oh, absolutely!
Especially.
Yeah, it's absolutely atrocious the kinds of things that have been done historically.
Well, thank you, Steve. Well, all right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be right back, and we're going to be discussing about what we can expect in this next congressional session. We'll be right back.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect, but the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo. A thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
Welcome back to the New American TV. Let's look at our next story. Congress is back in session this week, and House Republicans face two major issues going in the fall. What to do about another looming government funding crisis, and whether to begin an impeachment inquiry for President Joe Biden. In the case of a formal impeachment inquiry, Congressman Jim Jordan, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is sounding very confident that it will happen soon. Here he is talking to Mark Levin about it.
Impeachment inquiry on Joe Biden, yes or no?
Yes, I feel like we have to go there. The speaker's been clear. He said when the evidence and facts warrant us going to that level, we will do that. Because as you know, Mark, when you actually have a resolution that the House votes on and says we are majority of the House supports, the courts understand that when you're in this inevitable conflict with the executive branch to get documents and to depose certain witnesses, the courts understand the House is engaged in a fundamental constitutional activity, the impeachment power. So that's why an impeachment inquiry resolution is important for us to be able to get the information we need to get the facts and the truth to the American people. So I think it's warranted. I think we're likely to go there probably even this month. But that's a call in the end for the speaker. But I think he's been clear. If we need to go there, we will. I think it's about time for that.
Less clear is what's going to happen in the latest government funding battle. Some kind of spending legislation needs to be passed by September 30 to avoid a government shutdown, and battle lines are already being drawn. Congress will likely need until the end of the year to draw up the separate spending legislation now needed to fund government instead of the gigantic omnibus pork packages that used to be how they rammed through all sorts of unconstitutional and wasteful spending. This was agreed to in this year's earlier new budget agreement. But many House Freedom Caucus members who voted against the budget agreement with its huge new spending authorization are vowing to hold the line and to shut the government down unless House Speaker Kevin McCarthy holds a vote on an impeachment inquiry first and unless deep cuts in government spending are agreed to. Last month, the Freedom Caucus voted not to support any short-term government funding measures unless that measure also addresses the situation on the southern border, the Pentagon's new woke policies, and the weaponization of the Department of Justice. And adding fuel to the fire is President Biden's new request for $40 billion in supplemental funds, including $24 billion more for Ukraine. In other words, the Biden administration is asking for more money despite the terms of last June's Fiscal Responsibility Act that suspended the debt ceiling until 2025. This latest budget battle is likely to be more rancorous than normal and will feature the usual gloating by Democrats and the establishment media over the supposed ineptitude and ill will of so-called extremist Republicans. Here's a small taste of what we're going to be hearing over the next few weeks.
Well, budgeting reform would mean that legislators who are right at the edge of power, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Chip Roys and others who can, the Matt Gaetzes, who can hold the Speaker of the House essentially hostage to, you know, whatever positioning they've got. If when you have a narrow majority, you're not going to reform anything because someone in that equation has a lot of power. So my answer is unequivocally no. I agree with Greg's assessment, but the other, you know, fly in the ointment here is that before you get to this, some of those holdouts and those hardliners are demanding, you know, an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. Yep. And so I think Kevin McCarthy is going to have an interesting month.
I'm going to go back to Steve here. A lot going on, Steve. I know you've been keeping a top of this. Would a government shutdown be like the worst thing ever? Would it be so bad?
Well, no, we've seen this show before, and it always ends the same way, or at least up until now, it has always ended the same way. It starts with a bunch of principled Republicans saying, usually Republicans, I mean, I don't want this to sound overly partisan, but the fact is that to the extent that there's any semblance of fiscal restraint in D.C., it does reside within the Republican, within a wing of the Republican yeah. Party. So it starts when they say, absolutely not, hell no, we're not going to budge this time. And they put up a stand. And as predictably as the sun rising and setting, of course, the establishment media that has a vested interest in a perpetuation of the status quo, including, of course, the continuing increase in debt and lavishing of more and more money in big government programs that they adore, the Greek chorus of those folks come out and say, oh, this is terrible. Extremist Republicans are holding hostage. You know, you can't do this. Our national debt is sacred. We need a blah, 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 blah. And I don't know what they don't, of course, conveniently ever address is, well,
we need to honor our commitments.
Well, we need to honor our commitments. I mean, the usual pap. And what they never say is, what they never point out is, well, you know, what they're trying to do is cut some programs. There's, you know, and what they're saying is, no, you can't do this unconditionally. You need to sign off because the most important thing is to keep the money spigots open. Okay, and that's a whole different story that we have time to get into today, the relationship between continually increasing national debt and the inflationary or fiat money system that we have. Mm. That's a connection that no one ever remarks upon. But in any case, so
except
you know,
for
in,
us.
So in fairness to the Republicans, they are always the away team in Washington, D.C. You know, the home crowd is always rooting for the Democrats. And so then, of course, then they start ginning up all of these push polls that show that the public is outraged, that the Republicans have paralyzed the government. And all these, oh, it's such a shame. The national parks have shut down. And, you know, all these poor government workers and employees and bureaucrats are suddenly without a job. They don't have income. Of course, that never happens to those of us in the private sector, does it? You know, so people, again, never question this. So why is it, explain to me, why is it that government employees are uniquely entitled to a level of job security that us mundanes can only dream about? Sure.
Right.
So all of this is presented as if it's just a mortal sin. And ultimately, the Republicans came and say, okay, whatever. I guess I want to get reelected. You know, of course, they have lots of people calling in indignant. How dare you? You know, you're shutting down my government and on and on and on. So it's this whole thing.
So there's
going
to be a lot of pressure.
Right. So the anticipation is, you know, they're all, you know, rubbing their hands together saying, oh, yeah, we know that the right-wing wackos like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Chip Roy and Matt Gaetz mentioned in the clip and others are going to hold this thing up. And they certainly do have the power to do so. But, you know, that's just going to make them look bad. And yay, we're going to win back the House as a result and on and on. So they're just, they can't wait for this. The question is if things are play out differently this time around, if this faction holds its ground as it ought to, and there's a groundswell of support.
You have more faith in this wing and this faction than you have had in the past. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say faith is, that's probably too strong a word, but I've seen things that I haven't seen before from this particular group of so-called, you know, extremists or insurgents or whatever you want to call them, leads me to think that maybe this time will be different, that there will be some significant concessions.
Yeah. Anyway, so you were going to go on as far as the shutdown. It wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing.
No, actually,
what
it'd be
good
the best
things
thing.
Could come out of
it would be the best thing. So what would happen? First of all, they're not. It doesn't shut down essential functions like the military and that kind of thing. It's not like we're. I mean, you know, the southern border's wide open already. So who's going to notice the difference? You know, I mean, frankly, to be perfectly honest, the legitimate functions of the government, the defense of our national borders, chief among them, have suffered mightily
already.
Already. So who's going to even notice? But actually, they're not going to do that. These shutdowns never do that. They shut down things like national parks.
So you can notice.
Yeah. They deliberately do things that, you know, that hurt people, you know, the recreation.
And then they run articles. The media gets in and like, oh, people can't go to Yellowstone or they can't clean the toilets.
I mean, if it were up to me, which I suppose fortunately it isn't, I would shut down all the unconstitutional stuff, defund them, and it would be permanent. And all those hundreds of thousands of government bureaucrats would have to go out and find honest work.
Yes.
That's what I would do. And that would be, in the short term, it would cause some sort of this economic disruption because all of these, you know, overeducated, overqualified people are suddenly out there, you know, begging for work. There'd be issues, but in the long term, it would be great.
Well, we can't get to a stable condition without the disruption, right? I mean, there's just no way.
No, there's no way.
There's no way we could solve all the problems we have without some sort of disruption that will cause problems that we have to adjust.
Well, the piper will have to be paid. I mean, this is something that my second favorite country, Argentina, right now is going through. They're realizing if they're ever going to get out of this endless cycle of hyperinflation, there's going to be a stiff bill of goods to pay. And Javier Milei, the guy that's probably going to be elected president in a couple of weeks there, who is a libertarian, mm-hmm. has said, there's going to be a lot of short-term pain with my program, several years perhaps. But in the long term, things will be better if we have the character to stay the course. And that same calculus applies here in the United States.
We have to help people understand that there is no easy way out of this because it seems like everyone wants out of this, but at the same time, they don't.
It's going to come down to a question of national character.
Okay. Well, all right, folks, we're going to be right back after this break with more news.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S., unknown agents from around the world, using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Welcome back to The New American TV. So on Monday, the FDA approved updated COVID-19 injections for people 6 months and older. Today, outside advisors for the CDC will recommend who should get the shots, which are manufactured by Moderna and Pfizer. Once CDC Director Mandy Cohen signs off, the shots will be available. However, if you ask Dr. Ryan Cole, a pathologist who has reviewed a lot of post-vaccinal deaths, no one should be jamming those things into their body. Dr. Cole was a featured speaker for the John Birch Society's leadership conference this weekend in Des Moines, Iowa, and here's what he thinks of the shots.
Now, as a pathologist, I look at millions upon millions upon millions of cells every week, and the cells don't lie. The vaccines didn't work. They were a bad therapy at best, which now their effectiveness is negative. It's not a vaccine. It's below FDA EUA required efficacy. And you're hearing from the White House now. I'll get to that in a second. It doesn't prevent disease, doesn't prevent acquisition, doesn't prevent you from transmitting the disease, doesn't prevent the disease, and it showed no change in all-cause mortality or death. In fact, after the rollouts of the shots, all-cause mortality went up. So ask your doctor if a drug with 1,291 side effects listed on 32 pages, including blood clot, strokes, and heart attacks, is right for you. Safe and effective? Well, yes, I can see the test results here. The vaccine is safe and effective. And here's science gone rogue. Taking a gene and telling you it's a vaccine, injecting it into your body and saying it's a vaccine. It is a gene product. It is an injectable gene product. And they put it into your body with a lipid nanoparticle that's highly toxic, and then your body is supposed to tolerate that. And then it turns your cells into a spike protein factory. Your cells are human cells that are meant to make human proteins. Your cells are not pathogenic cells meant to make pathogenic proteins. When your cells make them, your cells are attacked by your own immune system.
And let's look at a few international news headlines. The Biden administration announced yesterday a prisoner swap deal with Iran. Iran will release 5 American citizens in exchange for the release of 5 Iranian citizens, plus the release of $6 billion in frozen Iranian assets overseas. The death toll in a devastating earthquake in Morocco has now passed 2,800 as officials in that desert nation continue to dig through the rubble in villages in the Atlas Mountains and in the historic city of Marrakech. The quake is Morocco's worst in more than 60 years. And North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un is on his way to Moscow by train to meet with Russian dictator Vladimir Putin to discuss the possibility of providing arms to Russia's military to assist with the war on Ukraine. We'll bring Steve in here. We got a few minutes. We got about 3 minutes, Steve. Which of those headlines pop with you the most?
Okay, well, first of all, just a quick correction. Apparently, Kim Jong-un has now arrived in Moscow. He had a very long train ride across Siberia, and we'll see what comes out of that. I think I think we know what's going to come out of that. The most interesting one, and the one that briefly riveted the attention of the news media yesterday, was the announcement on September 11th, ironically, that this deal had been agreed to, this latest deal to get American hostages / prisoners out of Iran, five in all. Sort of a 5-for-5 prisoner swap, but to sweeten the deal, the United States also agreed to free up. We're not technically giving them money.
We're freeing up
assets that had been frozen pursuant various sanctions and so forth imposed on Iran to the tune of $6 billion. And there is a conditionality attached to them, to wit, the Iranians can only use them for humanitarian purposes.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen.
Yeah.
Those Iranians and humanitarian purposes.
Yeah, so I mean, the timing of it, I think, politically was not very good. As far as hostage negotiations, obviously there's a tendency for people to, you know, people came down very hard on Biden for getting Brittany Griner out of Russia and all this type of thing in exchange for the merchant of death.
Yeah.
It's always ugly when you're trying to get hostages out. And there are a number of governments in the world, Russia, China, Iran in particular, that have this practice of seizing foreigners, convenient foreigners, to hold as hostages. China did it a couple of years ago.
As leverage, it makes sense.
As leverage, sure. Well, it makes sense in the cold calculus of this kind of, you know, international power politics. Yeah. It's fundamentally amoral, of course.
Yeah, I mean, so, it looks at humans being as little pawns.
Right, like, but the problem is, you know, and Biden seems to want to bring these people home, I guess half kudos to him for doing that. And frankly, in all fairness to him, I don't often say this, but it's not a not something where you're ever going to come out of it looking good. There will always people will claim, you know, you're appeasing this rogue regime or that. The alternative is to say flat out, we don't negotiate with tyrants and terrorists. Yeah. And there's a case to be made for that as well. But I don't know, a healthy dose of realpolitik may be in order. Now, of course, you know, contrast that with the way the Americans under the Jefferson administration handled the Barbary pirates. They didn't care about hostages. They simply sent the military in there and said, you know, this piracy is going to stop.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are different ways of handling these people.
Thanks, Steve.
That's all I have to say about that.
Well, all right, folks, that's it for our news segment today. For more truth behind the news, you make sure to go to thenewamerican.com and get a subscription. If you prefer, you can also do so by calling our office at 800-727-8783 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And now, here's my interview with popular ag radio personality Trent Luce.
Hey everyone, Paul Dragoo here of The New American, and I'm at the Jobber Society Leadership Conference, and I have with me Trent Luce, a 6th generation farmer, agriculture, and a popular radio host, and your focus is agriculture, right?
Well, first of all, where'd you get your poll that said I'm popular? Because today, you can't believe anything you get in a poll. So we better go back and do a little fact-checking on that, Paul.
Oh, you're popular. I hear. I mean, amongst... So I wanted to start...
Only with Tammy.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you've been doing so, great work highlighting the issues of agriculture, of ag producers. I think it's fair to say we agree that ag is under attack. What is the largest threat to agriculture today, or is that too wide, too broad of a question?
So I'm in my 24th year of trying to explain that domestic food production, I should say domestic food and fuel production, are means of national security. And we've lost track of that. We've lost track of that because we've had an abundance. And to get to tell you how we got to this point, Paul, in 1900, it required 10 acres of land to produce enough food to feed one person for a year.
Mm.
In 2022 or 2023, it takes a third of an acre to produce enough food to feed one person for a year. So we've made all of these technological advancements. We utilize fuel. Because 1 gallon of diesel fuel replaces 500 man hours of food labor production. You know, the concept of hoeing a row is completely foreign to most people unless they have a garden. And think about taking that garden and extrapolating that to food production like it was in 1900. And so all of those efficiencies and all of those technological advancements, including now soil health, is what we really need to focus on. For continuing to, because we have, and Norman Borlaug said it, Norman Borlaug, the only person from agriculture to ever receive a Nobel Peace Prize, he said in 2000 that there is no doubt farmers with the technology that is available can feed an ever-growing population of 10 billion plus.
Wow.
The question is, will the farmer be allowed to utilize the technology? And that's where we're at. We have land restrictions, we have CO2 pipelines, we have wind and solar, which are all removing land from food production. So, in a long way of answering your question, limitations placed on us by government and the restrictive use of our own property is what the greatest limiting factor of feeding the ever-growing population is.
Do you think there's a propaganda effort to make farmers, agricultural producers, look like villains?
My grandfather was born in 1918, Calvin J. Luce. My family came from Germany, by the way, in 1832, and we've been taking care of land and livestock ever since 1832. My grandfather, born in 1918, he quit school in eighth grade because he was needed at home to be a farmer.
Yeah.
And that's a common story with a lot of folks who had kids who grew up in the 30s, maybe the 40s, and they had to come home instead of go to, even to high school. If somebody told my grandfather that the word farm was now a four-letter word in some circles, he'd roll over in his grave. Because everything comes back to taking care of God's creation. That's what we're doing. We take care of God's creation, we improve it, and that's why we feed more people with fewer acres. But we also feed and provide the essentials of life to mankind because of what we do.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
How we get to the point where farm is a four-letter word, and people can actually say that farmers are emitting emissions. Well, let's talk about the emissions, because every single one of these emissions that they want to consider greenhouse gases are all plant food. They produce more plants. They produce a healthier soil. And so I keep coming back to the same thing, because what we have learned in agriculture and farming is that how we take care of the soil determines the microbial activity in the soil, determines how much organic matter is there, determines what the water holding capacity is. And that's why, if you drive up and down highways anywhere in the heartland today, you'll see that the crops are going to be tremendously good. You probably don't know that we have a rainfall that's parallel to what we had in the dirty 30s. But we didn't have environmental devastation of the dirty 30s because we have zeroed in on soil health, and we have so much more water holding capacity so that with less rain, we produce more food. By the way, CO2 is demonized in today's world, even though it's a plant food. But we also know that the more CO2 that is present in the atmosphere that feeds the plant, the less water the plant is requiring to produce more.
Yeah,
it just makes common sense. And so all of these integral components of soil health and producing more with less are what are really being challenged. And if we just turn the farmer loose and say, go do what you do, we'll never talk about a shortage of food or a supply chain disruption or whatever the case may be.
You've gotten on this, you joined in the battle on this, the carbon capture pipelines. When did you learn about that, and how much do you focus on that as far as where does that rank in threats against food production and agricultural producers?
I've said this, and I don't say it lightly, it's the hill I'll die on.
Wow.
Because nobody really knows what's going on with the monopolization of a tremendously essential element of nature called CO2. First of all, it's a cooling molecule.
Yes.
And yet we're being told that it's responsible for
increasing
the climate temperature.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? It's 1.5 times heavier than oxygen. So it doesn't even rise. It sinks. That falls prey to what the false notion of what they've been trying to tell us. And most importantly, we have three companies attempting to put in CO2 pipelines without telling us, number one, what the risk is of putting a CO2 pipeline in.
Right.
When there's a rupture, as valuable as CO2 is, when there is a rupture, how dangerous is it? Pork plants and turkey plants and chicken plants use CO2 to kill animals.
Well, but if there's a rupture at that point, it's liquefied and pressurized, right?
So correct. It's 20 in the pipeline itself. It's pressurized to 2,300 plus pounds of pressure per square inch. So when we concentrate and pressurize something, it then becomes dangerous. In the atmosphere, it's doing its job, and so it's such a convoluted thing. And the other thing, Paul, that I really want to talk about is, carbon sequestration is a good thing, and it's the only way plants grow. It comes back to soil health. When you have the right soil health, you have CO2, it feeds everything, microbial activity takes place. That is carbon sequestration. That's organic carbon sequestration. They continue to call putting CO2 in a pipeline, shipping it off to Christian County, Illinois, or Mercer and Oliver County, North Dakota. They can try to call that carbon sequestration. That's not carbon sequestration. That is entombment. That is putting it in a place for 12 years where nobody can touch it, and that is putting it in a tomb. We need to define the difference between carbon sequestration and carbon entombment. We are supporting carbon sequestration. We are supporting utilizing carbon to continue the life cycle, not to entomb it. And I truly believe that there's a purpose for demonizing the whole process and confusing the two. And I want to be a messenger of, this is important for carbon sequestration for plant growth. This is an inherent danger that man is creating, and that's putting it in a pipeline. To tell you how absurd it is, we're told that we have to do this to protect the environment. One of the great coal-fired power plants in this country is in North Dakota, Coal Creek Station, which now is called Rainbow Energy. And they just recently got, I believe it was a $39 million grant to do carbon capture. One-third of the electricity that they produce through burning coal will be required to compress and put CO2 in the pipeline. One-third.
Wow.
We are at a very critical point in our energy grid where we have turned to intermittent, unreliable, electric sources. Mm-hmm. We've shunned natural gas. We're retiring coal-fired power plants at an alarming rate, and we will live through rolling brownouts and blackouts in the very near future.
You mentioned this morning, I don't know what context it was, but the way it appeared to me is you were saying that even people who are part of these carbon capture pipelines, who are benefiting from somehow, even they know it's, I think you used the word stupid, mm-hmm. they know it is, but they're getting paid to do it. Can you elaborate on that?
A dear friend of mine, who I'll just leave his name out because I don't want him to think I was calling him stupid, which he says he's stupid, but he's been in the ethanol business his entire life. And he told me now coming, it was over 3 years ago, this spring, it was 3 years ago, he said, Trent, you won't believe it, but we're going to put CO2 from our ethanol plant in a pipeline. I'm like, what? Why would you do that? That's stupid. He said, it is stupid, but they're paying us too much money not to do it.
They being what, government?
Government subsidies. They being you and I who pay tax dollars. Most importantly, our children and our grandchildren are going to pay for this.
You're seems like a major component in the fight back against it. People watching and whatnot, maybe they be wondering, how can they get involved, or should they be worried? If they don't live in North Dakota and Illinois and Iowa where this is happening, should they be worried? And what's the best thing that people can do to keep this from coming to their communities, or if it already is there, to push back?
That is the most important question you could have asked me, because it doesn't matter where I go. I've been so obsessed with this now for 3 years that I think everybody knows about this. Most people don't know about this. And most people don't own land and where the pipeline is going to go across. In fact, I don't own land where the pipeline is currently going to cross. They may target me, but I don't currently. I own land, but it's not where the pipeline is planning to go. But when you start taking plant food out of the atmosphere and you put it in a tomb and you say you can't touch it for 12 years, at the same time that we've already reduced sulfur oxide from the atmosphere at a point where we have farmers who now have to add sulfur to their mix because they can't maintain soil health without the added sulfur. And why don't we have sulfur in the atmosphere? Because in 2006, the EPA started putting restrictions on sulfur and diesel fuel. Mm-hmm. It's like a calculated effort to say we're going to reduce the amount of plants. And the way that we have a healthy planet is that we have more plants,
right,
more animals, and the end result, more people. And we need people to manage all of these things, because government has proven they're unconstitutionally the largest landowner in the United States. 1 in 3 acres is owned by the United States government.
And that's mostly in the West.
Correct, mostly in the West. But 1 in 3 acres owned by the United States government.
Isn't like 90% of Nevada
owned by the 87.
Government? Wow.
And if you have friends in Nevada who are trying to manage the land to the best of its ability, not for production, but for ecological sustainability, mm-hmm. and you see what they're forced to do is we've removed logging, we've removed grazing. Greatest story. I got a dear friend in White Pine County, Nevada, Hank Vogler. He's been fighting this. He's been trying to keep his AUMs, animal units per monthly, out on the range, because we know that if you don't graze, you don't log, you have a higher fire load. Boulder County, Colorado. Nobody would consider that to be the conservative bastion of freedom. Louisville, Colorado, this week announced that once again this year, they're going to increase the goat and cattle grazing in Louisville, because they determined that this was really healthy for the ecosystem, that it minimized the impact of fire. Mm-hmm. And it created all of these healthy...
By grazing
and getting rid of... See, because cellulose material that a cow or a sheep will eat has no other purpose. If an animal doesn't eat it, it's going to burn.
Yeah, it's going to turn to kindling,
it's going to burn, and then you have all of those emissions, which, by the way, are all plant food. I'm not opposed to emissions, but you keep the animals grazing properly in a rotational mm-hmm. manner. So Louisville, you can go look this up, Louisville, Colorado, is now promoting that people should come September 5th through the end of September to watch the animals graze. It's a wonderful thing. It is. My most tranquil time is to go sit in the middle of my pasture with 100 certified Piedmontese cows around me and drink a beer.
That's funny.
There's nothing any better.
Yeah.
But to think about, they are now promoting that this is good. You can bring your pet, but keep it on a leash. And be careful with the fences. Don't crawl on the fences or pee on the fence because they could be electric.
Well, thank you, Trent Luce. Thank you for all you do.
I talk about peeing on the fence, you're going to cut me off just like that.
Well, do you think we answered what you can do?
No, we did not.
Well, let's finish
that. The most important thing you asked me and I didn't get to it, and that is this document.
There you go.
Called the United States Constitution is a piece of paper. And it lays right here in the center of this table. But the Founding Fathers said, this is your guide on how you maintain your liberty. We've given you the representative republic, but it's up to you
to keep it.
And we've been complacent. We've been sitting back. We've been expecting somebody else to take care of it. We've been expecting the last elected official we have to take care of this.
No.
The person that's going to take care of this is the person that you look at in the mirror every morning.
You know, that's what we tell our members is there's no one coming to the rescue. We are the cavalry. And if we don't get involved, this is what's coming. This is what's happening. We're seeing that, and it could get worse if we don't get involved. Sound right?
That's my language.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Keep up the good work.
And thanks for increasing my tribe on people that share our values and are going to stand up and say, not on my watch.
Absolutely. Where can people find you?
LooseTalesMedia.com. LOOSTALES media.com.
Thank you very much, sir.
Or freesoilcoalition.com.
There you go. Thank you again.
We can talk about the Free Soil Party. And, you know, Steve King's not going to show up, so we could use his time to talk about the Free Soil Party.
You want to talk about free soil?
Let Steve do it.
Thank you, sir.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon. Join us in restoring this great nation.
Steve Kenkel is a county supervisor in Shelby County, Iowa. We had an in-depth conversation about what local officials need to know when dealing with carbon capture pipeline companies. Mr. Kenkel provided very valuable information. Here's the interview.
Hey everyone, Paul Dragoo here for The New American, and I'm at the John Birch Society Leadership Conference, and joining me is Steve Kenkel. He is the county supervisor of Shelby County in Iowa. He's a fifth generation farmer.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Steve, for joining us.
Thank you.
If we can fight on the county level, that we can pretty much keep them from going through that area, then we can stop this thing, right?
I had a huge problem when they said, we don't need to get a permit. In our county, like most counties, if you want to build a house, you got to get a conditional use permit. If you want to put a deck on that new house, you got to get a conditional use permit.
Yeah.
Now, if you're an entrepreneur and you got enough property out back, you want to build your office back there, fine, come and get a permit, follows the ordinance. Now you have a high pressure, hazardous CO2 pipeline, and they say they can come between the house and your new office next to the kid's swing set, and they need nothing? Does that make sense?
Well, they claim they fixed the safety issues, right?
How? It's an asphyxiant. Under 2,200 pounds of pressure.
Yeah, are they making thicker pipes? Is that what they're claiming?
Yeah, I'm not gonna say that they're not constructing it properly, but I was also a water treatment superintendent for 43 years, and I worked in utilities, I worked with the one calls.
Mm-hmm.
Most times, it's an accidental dig.
Yeah.
It will happen. Somebody will hit it. Or down in Satarsha, Mississippi,
yeah.
It wasn't a dig. The ground shifted. Well, we freeze and thaw up here more than they do in Mississippi.
That's for sure.
And it's only 4 feet deep, our minimum.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things could happen.
Absolutely.
And then, like the town of Erling, it's on the east side of town. That's where the new housing is. But if you get... if it's below 30 degrees, cold, the wind's out of the north, it could blow it right through town at night in the wintertime. If something happened, they can't smell it, you can't see it. I do not want Erling, Iowa to be another Satarsha, Mississippi, and nobody knows about. At least down there, I don't know if you've heard that, but there, it had hydrogen sulfite because it wasn't pure as the CO2 is going to be up here. And that creates a rotten egg smell. And people were running away from the smell, not knowing what they were dealing with. Otherwise, they come across people laying unconscious in their vehicles that if emergency management people want to came and found them, the EMA director down there told me himself, Steve, if there wouldn't have been hydrogen sulfide in here, I do not know what kind of catastrophe we would have had.
My understanding is some of those people are still suffering.
That's what I've heard.
From that. You had 11 steps you wanted to share?
Yeah, I wanted to share, like, because I didn't have the luxury of pulling a book off the shelf, how do you prepare and protect your county for pipeline? I made a checklist of things where whether you're dealing with a pipeline or if somebody would have told me 3 years ago, there's a really good chance a CO2 pipeline could come through your county. I would have said, what's a CO2 pipeline? Mm-hmm. Why would they come here? I wouldn't have been prepared, which I wasn't.
Yeah.
But I wish I would have known all these things.
Well, share this with
okay.
our audience.
Okay.
What do you got?
First thing, the number one thing, if I could take of all of them, is hire an experienced utility pipeline attorney.
Okay.
That has from Iowa, he's versed in Iowa law to help you with the ordinance. Ordinance is the next important thing. Get a land use and zoning ordinance in place with proper setbacks to protect your county and your economic development areas.
All right.
Okay. Number two is implement or revise land use and zoning ordinance.
Okay.
Number three, revise or implement a road crossing permit.
Huh.
Because we have 25 roads in our county, rural areas, that they have to cross.
Mm-hmm.
According to Iowa code, they have to get consent from the county to cross those roads. It's not automatic. They can't eminent domain it, and they can't condemn it. Mm-hmm. So make sure the stipulations you want are in that road crossing permit, because that's one of the main authorities you have as a supervisor. Organize an intervention team of counties. Okay, what I mean by that is there's 29 counties affected by the Summit pipeline. Okay, it started as one. We hired our attorney.
Yes.
We went out and contacted and had conversations with other counties that were involved. Instead of all of us fighting this individually, we formed an intervention team of 8 counties. We didn't get 29, but we got 8. And we're using the same attorney, so we're all splitting costs equally. It's a lot more palatable and a lot more affordable, and we're all on the same page.
There you go.
Okay. Hire an experienced pipeline inspector, which is required when construction starts, so they know what's going on to protect your landowners.
Yes, that's important.
We're documenting the time. I've told each department head, If the pipeline companies get a hold of you and they want information and you have to go do things for them, you document the time, the day, and keep track of that time because that's above and beyond our regular call of duty.
All right.
Okay. Communicate with local utilities, your rural water districts in our area, the wind and solar. Make them aware that there's a possibility of this pipeline coming through and where, because we're finding out they're some of the last to know, and these pipelines are crossing major water lines, utility lines, and nobody was notified.
I can't believe that.
We can't either.
Does this sound, I mean, you've been in, so you're saying this is bizarre, you've never seen it.
Yeah, in fact, it's this bad. We're at the Iowa Utility Board now. It started August 22nd. I'm gonna say less than 3 weeks, could have been two, there was documentation in the docket, which people can file objections to the Iowa Utility Board, from a wind farm in one of the counties. They just got notification days before their final notice was that they were getting eminent domain on their wind farm that they have easements for, and now they want to take that easement away.
What do you attribute this to? This seems very unorthodox, like you said, and you've been doing this for a while. You've never seen this. How are they getting away
with it? It's not the way we do business in Iowa to start with.
Right. So how are they getting away with it? What made them think that's the way? Is it them? They just didn't know. They just thought they'd bulldoze through?
No, I've heard comments, and I feel they feel this is a federal project, so nobody needs anything.
Yeah, they don't. That makes sense. What else we got? How else?
Contact your cities, because like the city of Erlingham, they didn't know anything until I asked them about it. They were serving no legal notice. Mm. This was coming around, and you got metropolitan areas. Nobody knows, you know, because I think they would have jumped on some things and filed some objections sooner if they would have known. But if you don't know, make sure your local EMA, which is Emergency Management Association in your county, they're aware of this, and they can start planning for the different equipment they need.
Right.
Because otherwise they're not prepared.
Yes.
Hold some informed public meetings when you hear this to educate the landowners of the rights.
Yes, that seems to be very important.
Yeah, they had to kind of like find out on their own.
Yeah, and some of them made decisions they regretted, didn't they?
Right. I update my board at every meeting because we have the cameras there and the radio station, the news media. Let them know the progress and some of the challenges we're facing so the public understands whether you're out in the rural area or not, because even though I'm a farmer and it's not affecting me, I'm a mile from it.
Right.
I've had other landowners go, well, I ain't gonna worry about it because this doesn't affect me, and all I say is not this time.
Right, exactly.
This isn't the first. The last one, but not...
Certainly not least, Tom.
Right, is get your economic development director involved so he knows the impact this could have, not just on a city, but the entire county.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Steve Kankel.
Okay.
County Supervisor, Shelby County in Iowa. Thank you for everything. Okay. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. Remember to visit thenewamerica.com for more truth behind the news. Have a good rest of the day, and we will see you tomorrow.